Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating Atlanta's heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of Atlanta's elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Brad Culp. It's April 14th. It's a bright, sunshiny, warm day in Atlanta. I've got Sam Grass and Lee Cantor in the studio with me this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Brad. Okay, both at the same time. Ready?
Okay. We've been harmonizing.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, trying to get back in the swing of things after having spent a little time out of town for spring break, but We at least have some nice weather to come back to.
That's it, if you're okay with pollen.
Right. And we've got a terrific set of shows, a little bit of a departure from our usual format. This morning we're starting a two-part series on managing and financing the cost of long-term care. And we've got two guests in the studio that will be with us next week as well. We have Wally Kellerman and Dan Munster. Of course, before we do that, you've got to put up with my trivia for the day. Actually, today is disaster day. In 43 BC, Battle of Forum Gallorum, Brutus, the assassin of Julius Caesar, was in a battle with Mark Antony and defeated him. And actually, next week they battle again.
Oh, really?
And,
rematch?
Know, yeah, and Brutus wins again, unfortunately. 1865, Lincoln was shot in the Ford's Theater by John Wilkes Booth. And in 1912, the Titanic hit an iceberg and sank the following morning. So, and the NHL playoffs start today, and the Thrashers are not in it. So,
oh, they didn't make it.
Yeah, wow. I guess we don't need to keep talking about that.
Oh, we have the Hawks.
But the Thrashers coach just got fired.
Well, there you go.
Breaking news.
There's the segue. Let's jump on and move.
So, again, we're starting a two-part series this morning, and we're going to start off the topic by talking with Dan Munster a little bit about Medicaid and asset protection planning and long-term care as it relates to the Georgia Partnership Program. We also have Wally Kellerman in the studio with us, and the mic will be open, so it's really going to be more of an open forum discussion this morning. So welcome, Dan and Wally. Good morning.
It's good to be here.
Thanks for being here. Let's start out with you, Dan. If you could just give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself and how you decided to get into the practice of law and what you do and why you do it.
Sure. I'm glad to share a little bit about that. When I was in undergrad at Vanderbilt, I decided that the two things I enjoyed most were reading and writing, so I ended up in English and History double major, and there's not much you can do with that, so next thing I knew, I was heading off to law school, and following law school, I came down here to Atlanta and was very blessed to have the opportunity to work with Atlanta Legal Aid for 5 years. When I joined Legal Aid, I was given a chance to choose the group within Legal Aid where I would spend time. And so prior to that, I had been real close with my paternal grandmother and grown very close with her and had a chance to spend a lot of time with her friends and so forth in her assisted living and in her nursing home and just developed an affinity for an appreciation of spending time with elderly and the wisdom they have and the stories they can share. And so when given a chance at Legal Aid to choose which group I wanted to work with, I chose the Senior Citizens Law Project, which is a unique group within Atlanta Legal Aid focusing on providing care to indigent seniors. And so during those 5 years, I was exposed to pretty much all of elder law. And then back in 1999, I left Legal Aid and started my own practice, focusing on, among other things, the issue we're here to talk about today, planning for the cost of long-term care helping families understand how Medicare and Medicaid and VA benefits tie in with long-term care insurance.
Dan, before we get into the topic at hand, which is the financing of long-term care Medicaid, tell us at a high level what an elder care lawyer really does.
Sure, that is it's a great question, and it's very misunderstood, actually. Within the entire world of law, you've got criminal and you've got civil. On the civil side, there are many different types of lawyers, one of which is an elder law attorney, and in the big picture, elder law is less than 1% of civil practice of law, but actually within that tiny fraction of civil practice, there are many different specialties within elder law. And so there are lawyers who focus primarily on Social Security disability, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or guardianship and conservatorships, or estate and probate administration, or tax estate planning. There are many different types of elder law, or people who are practicing elder law and they don't really know it. Mm-hmm. I think that because all of those areas have their own pre-existing niche, people have come to think of elder law attorneys not necessarily exclusively, but a great deal, to a great extent, people who do the type of planning that I do and that Wally also does, which is helping families navigate the maze of Medicare, Medicaid, and VA eligibility.
And with that, the Medicare, Medicaid maze is your specialty. And so why don't you begin by starting there, rather, and tell us, what is Medicaid? What is Medicare? How do they interlink, if they do? And just kind of draw that picture for our listeners.
Sure. My experience is that most of my clients, who the youngest are typically in their 70s, and then the average in their 80s, and the older folks over 90, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the role that Medicare can actually play in the long-term care picture. And so I think it is important for your listeners to understand that Medicare was never intended to be a solution to the long-term care need that most people have before they pass. So Medicare originally was designed to provide, under Part A, hospital coverage, under Part B, outpatient physical therapy and so forth. Part C is the Medicare Advantage HMO plan, which is relatively new, and then Part D, which started in 2006, is the prescription drug program. Those are the only types of Medicare. So there are four types, and it's national. It's also not need-based, so that folks who have either themselves or their spouse, or in certain cases their parent, has worked and paid into the system, then Medicare will be there as their major medical coverage once they become eligible. Most people become eligible at age 65. However, for folks who are disabled prior to that, who qualify through the Social Security Administration for disability benefits, they can qualify for Medicare after a 2-year waiting period, even before 65. So that's Medicare. It's national. It's the same everywhere, and it's not need-based. Medicaid, on the other hand, is essentially the opposite, which is why it's so frustrating for me on many occasions to have to explain that these two entities are so completely different, and yet their names are almost identical. So Medicaid is funded with national dollars and state dollars, but in terms of the eligibility criteria, it's very state-specific. And so what we talk about here today a little bit, and I don't know that we should get too much into the technical rules of Medicaid eligibility, but what we do end up talking about is it's important for folks to understand is very state-specific. It's also need-based. So whether somebody is eligible for Medicare or not, or has paid into Social Security or not, they may qualify for Medicaid based solely on their assets and their income and their need. Mm-hmm. So Medicaid is certainly what most of us would think of as a safety net, whereas Medicare was something that was originally designed to be, in conjunction with Social Security, people's protection as they age. But again, there's no component of Medicare that pays for in-home care, pays the room and board at an assisted living facility, and for the most part, for long-term care in a nursing setting. There is a component of Medicare Part A which pays for post-hospitalization rehabilitation. Many of your listeners may have actually experienced this with their loved ones, where following a hospitalization of at least 3 days, then Medicare will pay the bill in full for 20 days mm-hmm. in a rehab facility. Mm-hmm. Then there's an additional 80-day period where Medicare can continue. The resident has a $133.50 per day copay, which hopefully their Medicare supplemental insurance will pick up. So best case scenario, between Medicare and supplemental insurance, you've got a 100-day window. But my experience is that the vast majority of people who come from a hospital to a long-term care setting don't actually get the full 100 days. So that's almost my number one thing that I would want to point out to folks is, notwithstanding what the social worker at discharge from the hospital, notwithstanding what they tell you, it's important to keep in mind that it's very rare for anybody to get the full 100 days, particularly if they're suffering from dementia, which will complicate their ability to participate in the therapy they're getting.
The average length of time for this Medicare payment is on average 30 days.
Let's go back and let's clarify. And this is a very complicated subject, and so I want to try to be as simple as I can. Under Medicare and the 180 days that you're speaking of, or that length of service,
100 days,
I'm sorry, that is for skilled rehabilitation services, is it not? It's not for what we call in my industry convalescent care, activities of daily living. Clarify that for me.
That's correct. In other words, what you're speaking about is custodial care.
Right.
And after the rehab period has ended, usually it's based on 30 days, if the resident has not reached baseline and can't reach, and cannot do more for itself, then they move into what's called the custodial care arena.
Oh.
And then Medicare says, we're done.
Okay. So I think we've established that in at a high level, in general terms, there are not long-term care benefits under Medicare. Is that at least a reasonable general statement?
That's 100% true.
Okay.
So let me just go back and clarify, though. In order to get that an additional 80 days, they have to continue to improve? Or what is it that
I can give you a real-life example. In being involved in this industry since 1994, I've had one client who has actually taken advantage of that. And the reason that she was able to do that was because her family was there every day, and every day she did rehab. And she was not expected to even live after brain surgery, had a terrific stroke, and the ordinary family would have just given up. This family did not. And she now lives locally in an assisted living, and she did do it. But
wow.
That is extremely rare, and it took a lot of commitment on a lot of people's parts.
Can I come on that?
Yeah.
Comment on that
Please.
As well? I have a couple of thoughts. First, it is rare. The times when I've seen it go the full 100 days typically doesn't have anything to do with physical, speech, or occupational therapy. It has to do with somebody who's receiving wound dressing mm-hmm. or who's on a feeding tube, or things that are, under Medicare's regulations, considered skilled care.
Right.
From a therapy perspective, we could spend the entire show on this topic, where I've seen essentially what happens is what's going on out there in the real world is not necessarily what the federal law says.
Right.
The federal law actually says that restorative potential is not determinative, and in fact, if the person is, in terms of declining, staying the same, or improving, what most facilities will do is say, your mom or your dad has plateaued, they're not improving, and therefore we're going to discontinue therapy. That's what they're going to say every single time. However, if you look at the Code of Federal Regulations, what it says is, as long as the therapy is helping them to stay the same mm-hmm. or prevent deterioration, then it should continue. And so There is a process by which families can go through the demand bill process where facilities are required to provide at least 3 days advance written notice of Medicare termination, where families have the opportunity to disagree with the facility's thought that therapy should stop. The facility is not the final arbiter of what Medicare will or won't pay, and so families can choose to request that the therapy continue, that Medicare be billed, and that if Medicare rejects the claim, then the family's on the hook private pay.
Right.
The problem is that, you know, I hate to be defeatist, but we probably shouldn't spend much more time on this because the reality is nobody goes through the demand bill process. Most facilities don't even give the written notice where people are then having have a chance to file that demand bill appeal, and they don't want to alienate the facility that's providing care to mom or dad.
Right.
I don't really understand it because facilities obviously are compensated greater if they continue the therapy, but for whatever reason that I'm not aware of, they choose to use that plateau standard.
Dan, you're absolutely right. And having a working knowledge of Medicare, we could spend more than the show on that. So let's bridge from there. I think we've established that in general terms in practice that there's not a benefit for long-term care under Medicare. So let's move to Medicaid. And I think we, in general terms, you spoke that there is some benefit there based upon qualifying needs. So let's talk to start there. Tell us what those qualifying events are for Medicare.
Medicaid.
I'm sorry, Medicare. See, that's what happens with Medicaid.
Right. Here in Georgia, we've got somewhere between 30 and 40 types of Medicaid, which, remember, back under Medicare, there are only four types. Here in Georgia, we have somewhere, again, more than 30 types of Medicaid, and all of them don't necessarily relate to the elderly. In terms of my practice and the elder law world, those that typically come up are obviously hospital Medicaid, nursing home Medicaid, hospice Medicaid, and a program called the Community Care Services Program, which hopefully we'll have some time to talk about. That's Georgia's, I don't want to say virtually non-existent, but very, in my opinion, deficient home-based Medicaid program. But for the most part, here in Georgia, our Department of Community Health and our legislature has not decided that funding Medicaid for home and community-based care is a top priority. Of course, this is another soapbox that I typically get up on, the fact that statistically, the state can provide care for four people in home for what it costs for one person to be institutionalized, and those four people would rather be at home than in a nursing home. However, the Community Care Services Program doesn't get the funding that it needs, and because it's a waivered class of assistance, it has a finite number of slots. Those slots are always full, and there's always a waiting list. It doesn't mean people shouldn't call and get on the waiting list. But there are a lot of people who would like Medicaid-provided home care who don't end up getting it because the financing isn't there.
What is the waiting period right now on average?
I don't have a specific number for you, but it's typically at least several months, 6 months, and a lot of times more than a year.
Yeah.
It's also something which my experience is that they'll tell you there's a waiting list, but that it's not necessarily first come, first serve. And if somebody shows up with immense needs, they probably will get bumped up the list. Mm-hmm. So that's home care. Fortunately, in terms of the eligibility criteria, that program has the identical financial eligibility criteria as nursing home Medicaid and hospice Medicaid. So they're all the same in terms of what people must show to document their need. If you want to get into the specific numbers, I'm happy to do that. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking.
I want you to go. Yeah, I'd like for you, at a high level, talk about, I mean, as you said, there's a needs test, and I think our listeners need to understand what that means and what that is.
Okay. I guess my first thought is that this is one of my top two long-term care myths, and that is that there's a public perception that in order to ever qualify for help through Medicaid, one must be destitute, that one must sign over all their property to the state. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. But the reality is that one doesn't have to be destitute, especially if they're married. A married couple here in Georgia, any one of those three classes of assistance I was just talking about, their assets are complete exempt assets, can be owned of unlimited value. A few years ago, there was a limit placed on the value of a home place for somebody who's not married at $500,000, but that limit doesn't apply to somebody who's married.
Okay, so let me again, in lay terms, expand on that. I am married. I am 75 years old. I need to be in some type of, I need to receive long-term care. I have $1.5 million home. That $1.5 million asset is exempt from the needs test?
That is a true statement. It's an extreme example, but
it
makes the point. A similar extreme example is that somebody can own a $1.4 million Bugatti, and if it's used for transportation, that one vehicle is exempt regardless of value.
Okay.
So just tell me, what are the exempt assets? Obviously, a primary home, a primary vehicle for transportation.
That's a very dangerous question to answer, Brad, so I'll be careful about that. The reason is that both on a federal level and also on a state level, the pool of exempt assets has been getting narrowed greater and greater and greater over the last, let's say, 10 years for a variety of reasons. And so what's exempt today may not be exempt tomorrow. Mm. In general, the home is exempt. A vehicle used for transportation is exempt. A minimal amount of property set aside for prepaid burial planning is exempt, and that, again, is a half-hour conversation in itself, helping families understand the interplay between life insurance and prepaid burial expenses and burial-designated funds. There's a lot of misinformation out there about that, and any errors can result in a denial, so it's dangerous to get into those details now. Things that are no longer exempt but used to be, people used to be allowed to own rental property, now they're not. Certain types of annuities, which used to be exempt and used as part of the process of planning, in 2006 Congress passed some new laws which restricted the way that annuities can be used, if at all. There's been some litigation about that here in Georgia. And from the consumer side, successful litigation, but it's still a bit dangerous because the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has entered the Georgia litigation and basically said, we disagree with the Superior Court judge and we're overruling. So now there's going to be some discussion about that.
Now, what would happen if you said that if you're married, you get this exemption? What happens if, in the process, you're getting this exemption, you're getting these benefits, then the spouse dies? Now all of a sudden a switch flips and you're not eligible?
You mean the spouse who's at home, the healthy spouse?
Right.
Okay. Let me finish first the eligibility big picture. Exempt assets not limited in value. In addition to that, a married couple in Georgia is collectively allowed to have up to $111,560 of non-exempt property, which is just cash, CDs, stocks, mutual funds, whatever you want. Those dollars are set aside primarily because there is what's called the community spouse. The goal is to avoid her from having to be impoverished, and I say her because it's typically a younger woman who's healthy with a longer life expectancy married to a man who's in long-term care in a marital situation. The goal was to protect her, and so Georgia has two community spouse laws designed to protect her. The first is a much higher asset limit. If the person's not married, the asset limit is only $2,000. If the person's married, it's $111,560 plus unlimited exempt property. That's the first rule that protects the spouse. The second is called the spousal impoverishment income diversion, which says that the spouse at home gets to keep the first $2,739 of the couple's monthly income before the person in the nursing home has to pay any patient liability. So for couples who have a combined income of less than $2,739 a month, and that's a number specific to this calendar year and changes every year, the spouse at home actually gets to keep all of the income, plus $111,560 of non-exempt property, plus all of the exempt property, and husband in the nursing home is still eligible. And so I wouldn't call that completely destitute.
Yeah, I'm saying you're right. I think it's important to bring that up. I didn't mean to interrupt. I did, but I apologize. I think it's important for our listeners to know that, in my mind, to qualify for Medicare, you had to You had to sell off all your assets or get rid of all your assets. And what you're saying is that's not a true statement. And I think at a high level, that's what our listeners need to remember.
There's no question about it that that's a huge area of misunderstanding that assets, and this gets to Lee's question about what happens if someone dies, at least during life, in terms of the process of somebody being approved for Medicaid. The state doesn't take anything from anyone at any time at that point. They basically say, tell us about your property, and if your property is outside the rules, then they deny your application and tell you to come back when you are within the rules. Getting to his question, though, which is kind of a tricky area depending on which spouse dies, Georgia does have, as of 2007, estate recovery. And estate recovery is something that, you know, we may want to talk about a little later in the conversation, but essentially that's the idea that following somebody being on Medicaid, when they pass away, then to a certain extent, some or all of the money that Medicaid has spent for them might be recovered. I say might because in a marital situation, assets belonging to the community spouse shouldn't be subject to estate recovery. Moreover, even if they are, because they happen to have been jointly owned with the person who was on Medicaid, the federal law and therefore the state law, which has to mirror the federal law on estate recovery, says that any recovery has to be deferred until the death of the second spouse. So, and then finally, which is a huge point that I try to make for my clients, estate recovery does not simply say that if you're on Medicaid for one day and then you happen to pass away, then the state is going to take all of your property in your estate. That's another common misunderstanding. Instead, what happens is the state is required to keep track of the dollars they spend for you. Those dollars are a function of what the facility's Medicaid rate is, which every facility has a different Medicaid rate, mm-hmm. and also a function of the resident's patient liability. So that if I have a client who's paying $2,800 a month of patient liability, as an example, and that facility's Medicaid rate is, let's say, $4,400 a month, which I know is less than the private pay rate, but that's the point. Medicaid rates are lower. Mm-hmm. Then in that example, Medicaid is only paying $1,600 a month towards the cost of that person's care, so that over the course of an entire year of being on Medicaid, there's a $19,000 lien on their $200,000 home place,
right,
or something.
Right.
So I try to emphasize that if mom is in need of long-term care, and I just had this conversation with somebody yesterday, children who have become reliant on parents or who are concerned about assets passing to the next generation, right, sometimes make decisions based on the fear of estate recovery,
right,
that aren't necessarily in the best interests of mom or dad who actually needs long-term care. And so it's important that folks understand that estate recovery isn't necessarily the ultimate evil that it's perceived to be.
I think that's vitally important, that, again, this is not a situation where the individual must be destitute, must have gotten rid of all assets in order to qualify for Medicaid and potentially long-term care benefits. Dan, I also know that there's another program out there that you and Wally are both involved in and would like to speak to, and that is the Georgia Partnership Program and how it relates to Medicaid. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I'll let Wally chime in as much as she wants to. Do you want to start and I can follow on you? Or do
all
you
right.
Want me to
jump well,
in?
The Georgia Partnership Program has actually had a history in other states, which started in the 80s. I come from New York State, and I understand now that it all ties in with the state recovery, and I understand now that those people who bought those long-term care insurance policies back in the 80s are now entering into the nursing homes in New York State. And so from those four states that were originally approved, this idea was brought up again a couple of years ago by various U.S. senators, and Hillary Clinton had a plan. There were four or five. And then each state, and I think we have covered almost every state now, where the states now work with Medicaid. And going back to the New York program, since ours is not really, we don't have any stats yet, but the length of time that an individual stays in a nursing home setting, and I'm going to just use this as a nursing home because long-term care insurance can pay for homes, assisted livings, and et cetera. To keep this as bare bones as possible, let's just talk about the nursing home. The average length of time in a nursing home is thought to be around 2.3 years. It could be a little longer. So if you bought a two-year or a three-year partnership policy in New York State, and you had a pool of money, let's say it was $200,000, and your long-term care was paid for in the nursing home, you would then have that $2,000 worth of credit, which you could preserve and not be billed under this estate recovery program. In other words, they would now have that, and that would be probably unlikely they would ever actually need Medicaid based on that 2.3 mm-hmm. years. Now, I'm going to just let Dan hop in here because he's actually been intimately involved with the Georgia program. That's, you know, kind of the old news from New York. Let's find out what Dan has right. to say about what's going on now.
Okay. Well, it's definitely something new here in Georgia. As part of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, which Congress didn't pass until 2006, they opened the door for all other states beyond those four original states, which I think were New York, California, Connecticut, and Indiana, I think, mm-hmm. or Illinois, one of those two I's in the Midwest. So now all states are allowed to do it. Georgia, to its credit, immediately jumped on the opportunity, which essentially it's a public and private partnership between the state Medicaid program and private insurance, designed to give people an incentive to insure themselves. Mm-hmm. The reality is we already have discussed Medicare doesn't cover long-term care. Who knows where Medicaid will be 5 or 10 or 20 years from now? And so I think that most professionals feel that long-term care insurance has to be a significant part of the solution to our country's long-term care problem that we face. I mean, everybody knows there's a wave of baby boomers that are going to be hitting in the next 20 years, and where they go and how they pay for it is going to be critical. So to the extent that they can afford long-term care insurance, it's an absolute no-brainer in my opinion, and that's why both Wally and I have actually, in addition to our law practice, created separate insurance agencies to make that insurance available to the children of our clients. So this program is designed to provide an incentive by not only from an estate recovery perspective, as Wally was saying, but actually on the front end from an eligibility perspective, play a role in the approval process. So that back when I told you a married couple was allowed to have $111,000 of countable property, that number is different for somebody who has exhausted their long-term care partnership program policy as follows. If somebody has purchased a long-term care partnership program in Georgia, subsequently taps into that policy for their care, and it has a limit of $200,000 of benefits, mm-hmm. following the exhaustion of that long-term care insurance, if that person is still alive and in need of long-term care, they can actually go and file with the Department of Family and Children Services for Medicaid eligibility, having exempt assets of unlimited value, and now, instead of $111,000, $311,000 on the front end, they can be approved, have all that money in the bank, and be eligible and receive help. And on the back end, none of that property, which was protected through the partnership program policy, is subject to estate recovery. So it's a brilliant concept to give people an incentive to get the insurance, and from the state's perspective, to shift the cost of the beginning of the person's need for long-term care onto private industry, taking the responsibility for the back end essentially hoping that people don't end up needing it on the back end.
That is a beautiful, and I spoke with Wally about this several times, and I have a background in this, and I couldn't connect all the dots till just now, and I understand exactly what you're saying. There is an incentive after you exhaust your long-term care or through the partnership program. There is a benefit, let's say, after you exhaust your personal long-term care benefits. And that's a beautiful, beautiful relationship. And you don't have to sell down, buy down, give away all your assets in order to participate in it.
You know, most elders worked very, very hard for their money. They went without. They came through the Depression. And they saved. And what they thought they saved would be enough. And it really isn't. And they are willing to spend a little bit on themselves, but quite honestly, they do want to pass something on to their children. And in a very simple way, this brilliant idea is going to give this back to our elder community who has worked so hard, is the grassroots of this country, will be able to pass something back to their children.
So I will summarize this, that anyone who if you've tickled their interest with this conversation, can contact you, and you can sit down and explain this probably about four times to them, like it took me before the light finally was turned on. I encourage individuals who are listening to take that initiative.
Can I make one more point about
Certainly.
That? This ties back in with my comment about the fact that Georgia's current Medicaid program is fairly deficient when it comes to home and community-based care. Until we change that, the Georgia Long-Term Care Partnership Program doesn't really have the teeth that it could have. And the reason is that having a higher Medicaid asset limit doesn't really do you any good if you're at home and you exhausted your $200,000 of long-term care insurance to provide for care in home. And at that point, you're not yet ready to be institutionalized and you'd like to stay home, so you'd love to apply for Medicaid and get help to do that if there's no program to actually provide that. And so this is why every opportunity I get, and I appreciate this opportunity, I yell from the mountaintops that people really need to, on a personal, grassroots, statewide level, promote the idea that Georgia really does need to explore the idea of expanding our home and community-based Medicaid programs so that the partnership program will actually provide the incentive that it was intended to do, which is get people to get their insurance.
And I hear what Dan is saying is we need our Georgia Tea Party in this area.
And it's even worse than the waiting list, and confirm if I'm right or wrong, but it seems to me, and I don't have any statistics on this, but it seems to me that every time we hear about an individual that wants to take advantage of Medicare in a skilled nursing facility, they're being sent to South Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, because there are no Medicaid slots available in the local Atlanta area.
That is actually probably the biggest problem that folks who call me face. I can typically fix whatever their legal problems are, but I can't manufacture a bed in a nursing home that they consider to be a good one. My personal feeling is that there are great nursing homes, there are good ones, there are average ones, and there are bad ones. For the most part, they all take Medicaid, which is that's the other of the top two misunderstandings about Medicaid, is that there are the dirty, bad Medicaid ones, and then there are the fancy, you know, rose-smelling, right, expensive private ones. And over the past few years, there have been a few of those to open in Georgia through the concept called a continuing care retirement center, where if you have multiple millions of dollars, you might consider that. But for the average person, that's not really an option. There are hundreds of nursing homes outside of those in Georgia, and every single one of them, except for one, participates in Medicaid. So the great ones, the good ones, the average ones, and the bad ones, they all participate in Medicaid. You can be there on Medicaid. The issue is, can you get the bed in the first place?
Right.
And so the point you raise is excellent, and that is that under federal law, facilities are allowed to ask people, tell us what your assets are on the front end when you're outside knocking, can I come in? And if they're not enough, they're allowed to say go away. And so it's imperative that, that listeners understand that the greatest leverage they're ever going to have to get a bed in a good facility is the 100 Medicare days. Following hospitalization, if they need some sort of post-hospitalization rehab, those 100 days are the biggest crowbar they're ever going to have to get the front door open at a better facility. Private pay is the middle rate of reimbursement, and then Medicaid is at the bottom. Whereas the law allows the facilities to discriminate based on source of payment up front, if somebody is moved from a hospital into a nursing setting or a rehab setting, which, by the way, they all have taken the word nursing home out of their name and put rehab in, but they're all still Medicaid-certified long-term care facilities. If that person comes off of Medicare while they're there, and converts to Medicaid, they're not allowed to, the facility can't discharge them, they can't retaliate, they can't do anything once somebody converts to Medicaid.
Dan, great information, and I know it's very complicated. In summarizing, if you could offer our listeners one high-level piece of advice in regards to the planning and financing of the long-term care, what might that be?
My tip actually doesn't have anything to do with Medicare or Medicaid or any of the rest of this. It sort of ties in, and that is, I think that there's a great need for everybody, certainly of all ages, to have a Georgia Advanced Directive for Healthcare, which is our statutory medical power of attorney. Our old documents, our living will and our medical power of attorney, were combined in 2007 into one document called the Georgia Advanced Directive for Healthcare. And in addition to that, I think people need to have a comprehensive, general financial power of attorney. And the reason I emphasize this is that typically, as folks age, their adult children are the ones who end up taking responsibility for their decision-making. And what the law says is that there needs to be somebody who has this power of attorney to actually have the authority to make the decisions that are necessary, so that if there isn't anybody to do that, then there's nobody to do any planning for purposes of Medicaid or for purposes of VA benefits or for purposes of contracting with a long-term care insurance company. There's just nobody there. And so my number one tip would be that folks understand how imperative it is and not to wait until it's too late, because once someone has lost capacity, they can't give power of attorney. Mm-hmm.
And just to piggyback on that, oftentimes these matters end up in court. That's an expensive process. And in the end, you can't do this asset protection planning effectively.
We really appreciate the, both of you being here. Dan, if our listeners would like to contact you, how can they do that?
Well, first, they're welcome to go to my website, which is GeorgiaElderLaw.net, the word Georgia spelled out in full. I've got a series of frequently asked questions there that I think people would find helpful, and certainly if they have questions, my phone number and email address are there. My phone number is 404-920-0521.
Thank you. Wally, how could our listeners contact you?
I can be reached at kellermanlaw.com or a national website, nolo.com. Go to Georgia, go to Gwinnett, and then go to, actually, elder law happens to be under family law and estate planning.
Well, we appreciate both your being here. We appreciate your expertise and all the information that you provided us.
And we're out of time for this week. We are going to continue this discussion next week on April 21st. In the meantime, if you didn't catch this show live, well, you'd be listening to it because you've gone to our website, but it can be heard on www.ugeriaradio.com. Thank you to both of our guests for being here today. We look forward to next week, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Tune in again next week at the same time. And remember, if our children are our nation's greatest asset, then seniors are our nation's greatest treasure. Thank you again, and we'll see you next week.
Ugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and is recorded in the Business Radio X Studios.